Hello, dear travelers. This is Noah Symes. I am an actor here at the Penumbra Podcast. We are coming to you in the off-season with a little Q&A. I'm sitting here with the illustrious creators of the podcast.
I'm Sophie Kaner, co-creator, co-producer, director, sound designer, and sometime actor, although trying to move away from that as much as I can.
And I'm Kevin Vibert, lead writer, recording engineer, co-producer, co-creator, occasional rabbit.
That's true.
Occasional rabbit.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. So we wanted to answer some of your questions, travelers, in the off-season here while we rest and recuperate after the onslaught of emotions that was season one. And so we have collected several of your questions from Tumblr and email and Twitter, and we have picked out some of those to talk about today. And so thank you for sending them in. So we'll start from a sort of origin story standpoint. What films, books, shows, or authors inspired the world of the Penumbra, the world, the story, the characters?
The Twilight Zone.
Yes.
That was like our whole first concept for the show, which it's probably pretty obvious that we've diverged from that pretty far at this point, because originally the show was meant to be much more of an anthology, and each episode was going to be standalone.
Right, which is particularly evident, I think, in Shaken and Home.
Right, Right, Shaken and Home were the first two that we wrote, even though we didn't release them in that order. And we sort of thought it was going to be horror stories, mostly, to begin with. And then we were like, oh, let's not hold ourselves to that. You know, how can we broaden this? And what we came to was, all right, well, our story's going to be sort of either spooky or a bummer. which, for a That's time, right. was our motto. And we haven't quite stuck to it, but we have a lot of bummers in there, for sure.
Yeah, we're good at the bummer
stuff. Right. Yes.
We're really more bummer or a big bummer.
with an occasional spoop. But also, of course, there's like the concierge, who is like that Rod Serling mm-hmm. figure, you know, who mm-hmm. you don't really know much about, and there's no real explanation for him, but he guides you through the stories. So we've maintained that, and that's kind of where the structure, I think, came from. And then if we talk about, so I mean, Juno is the long-running series. I'm inspired by Sherlock. I especially was to begin, I think maybe less and less so as we continued with it. Sound design and character design-wise, I personally am really inspired by Mad Men, which is one of my favorite shows. Mm-hmm. Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Yes.
Which, I mean, is a kind of funny thing to reference because it is itself so referential. Like, the whole point of it...
It's its own noir parody.
Right. It's a noir story that is a noir parody, and so it's a little bit silly to use that as a reference point, but it's one of our favorite movies.
Right.
And a big inspiration, for sure.
Right. I think for me, it was a lot of... I've been thinking about it and kind of going back through as I'm thinking about the noir stories that really inspired me. And I think for me, a lot of it has been reading a lot of noir stories and liking a few of them, like a lot, like a whole lot. Like the book, The Maltese Falcon, is one of my favorite books, period. There's a type of action and a type of suspense that I really think it does well and that I would like to do. So part of the reason that I like Who Framed Roger Rabbit as an analog is that it is... like the perfect noir story. It hits all of the beats to the point where it's even about like a real estate crisis in California.
Right.
Does That's all that classic. Stuff, but it does it in a super engaging, gripping way, which is like always in my mind about the show, I think.
Yeah. And don't forget another one of your big inspirations.
The Manual Detection?
No, that isn't even what I was going to say, although that is a great book. Frickin' Phoenix Wright.
Yes, Phoenix Wright, absolutely. I thought about that a lot, especially around...
So just because I'm an idiot, will you tell me what Phoenix Wright is?
Yeah, it's a series of games where you basically play as a defense attorney. It's like a visual novel.
Yeah, visual novel. Yeah. Which is why I'll put up with it.
Yeah.
Because, like, I really have not got the patience for most video games, unless they're really story-heavy.
Right.
And this is like you sort of play your way through a case.
Right.
But and even with those, like, you know, they're goofy, they're silly, and they're very cartoony. And the thing that they're really good at that I've been more and more inspired by lately is that, man, those cases, those games know how to set up a mystery in a really, really gripping way.
Yes, they do.
And then just bring you on the roller coaster so that even more so than just solving it, it's about like kind of feeling the excitement every step of the way.
Yeah.
Something that I've really appreciated about the Juno stories is how certain episodes have sort of had their own sort of genre influence or
yes,
you know,
that's
like, and I know
true.
you've told me off microphone that you know, for Day the Wouldn't Die,
Stephen King's It.
Right.
And
it's just straight modeled on that.
Right. And the Train to Nowhere was very based on Bond films.
Yes, that's Train from Nowhere, please be respectful.
Was that a name change? Was it ever Train to Nowhere?
We waffled back and forth for a while.
Okay,
for sure.
So I'm not crazy.
No, you're not crazy. Right.
I'm just stuck in the past.
that's James Bond. And I mean, it's hard to say with Angel of Brahma because that was sort of so much. Oh, well, Angel of Brahma ended up being Star Wars, really.
Right,
like,
right,
by the time
right.
all was said and done. But Kevin and I also know that we went through, what did you say, 22 drafts?
No, so it's
because at some point it was Oliver Twist.
It was Oliver Twist. It was Wicked.
Right. It was four completely different versions of the backstory.
It was Batman. 22 drafts. Yeah, it was like as many things. It ended up being Star Wars, I think. But but another thing we talked about for like in Angel of Brahma and Resting Place, like I guess more Angel of Brahma, the part where they're like sort of trapped with miasma, we were thinking Dracula, like when like just like being in the monster's stronghold and like hanging out with them a lot. So yes, we're like taking the noir thing, putting it on Mars, and then
layering another
and then interpreting other genres through that. So there is a lot on our plate. Should we probably address other things than Juno?
Yeah.
While we're here.
Yeah. What about Second Citadel?
A lot of what we talked about is more visual.
Yes.
Which is kind of funny. I thought Pirates of the Caribbean for a while because it's sort of, it's like fantasy, quote unquote, period, but like not really a real time. And it's also very anachronistic, very modern, and very like goofy, silly, action-packed. And you know, there's battles and stuff, but you don't worry too much about what's going to happen to the characters.
Yeah.
It has that lightness about it.
In terms of the monster, the Janus Beast, but also other monsters that we've been talking about in Secret Sense, my biggest analog is always, like Labyrinth or, the Dark Crystal or other Jim Henson fantasy, right? Because
it's Muppety or
googly
stop motiony.
Right.
Or,
there's a sort of goofy grotesqueness.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah,
yeah. Scary,
but
scary
not
via
ultimately
grotesque
that,
goofiness.
That threatening, yeah.
Yeah. And we talked a little bit about Home and Shaken being very Twilight Zone-y.
Although, well, Shaken is meant to be pretty Twilight Zone-y.
Right.
Home is meant to be more
kind of Spielberg-y.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The whole, like, you know, as even just the trope where like the parents come home
and then it's kind of
all
okay.
The trouble disappears.
And then I
Coyote
mean
of the Painted Plains.
Yeah, Coyote, it's Western.
But it's but remember when we talked about it, it doesn't actually follow the tropey rules of a Western. It's actually a swashbuckler, right? Because a Western is all about like slow, tense moments, and Coyote's not that. Coyote is the hero, like swings in, breaks a window. Swoops in and grabs the, you know, whoever needs to be saved and then rides off into the sunset.
Yeah.
So even when we were talking about Coyote,
true.
We had that in mind.
That's true. Yeah.
One of the things that I think actually works really well is that very often we completely disagree or just come from different angles.
Yeah.
In terms of our inspirations.
Yeah. And you get what you get.
That's right.
And you don't get upset.
Or you do.
Or you
we're
do.
We're not here to tell you how to feel.
No, we're not.
Next question. How do you plan out the mysteries that Juno solves? Do you have a process for staking those out, for creating those?
Kevin will sometimes like really crystallize, like after a lot of thought, will really crystallize a method for doing something. And he has fairly recently figured out what our approach is. And you can expand on this because it's totally your idea. And I think for you, this might be a little bit inspired by Phoenix Wright again.
Yes,
but the whole, like, what we've sort of come to with mysteries is, let's start with an impossible thing, an impossible situation, basically, mm-hmm. like that someone mm-hmm. could come upon, and then figure out how it could have happened, which is sort of funny because you would expect that with a mystery, like as the writer, you would start from the inside and work your way out.
Right, yeah.
But it seems to work much more successfully when we actually start on the outside.
And one of the reasons that works really well is it's very important to me to give the audience a hook right away, kind of like an immediate sales pitch for like, hey, if you stick around, this is what you're going to find out about. Right?
Right.
So that's part of the reason I think the first story where I really had that figured out was pretty late in the game. It was Train from Nowhere, where like the very first thing that happens in Train from Nowhere is you see this impossible train. It cannot be boarded. It's moving too fast to see. And then Nureyev just says, hey, we're going to catch that train. And it's this very exciting, like, how?
Yeah. And then we were like,
but how?
Exactly.
And we had to figure it out.
Cool. If you can talk a little bit about how you cast the voices of the characters, you know, did you have ideas in mind about how you wanted the characters to sound, or were there specific people as you were writing that you had in mind for things, or did you sort of write and then let the actors' voices inform what they sounded like? What was that process like?
So part of how this has worked, interestingly, is that, like, each episode kind of serves as an audition for what's to come, because then you learn about, or I learn, I mean, I cast it. I learn about, you know, what the actors have to offer, and it might not always be what I expect. So, like, starting from the very beginning, the first thing we did was Shaken, and, you know, we didn't know it was going to be a thing. We were just going to do this for fun. So I was like, oh, I'm going to play the lean character.
Is that what you sounded like?
Yeah. Mm. And I
incredible
went on to...
Yeah.
Yeah, this voice that I have now is learned. this was the best I could muster up. yeah, so I was just like, okay, well, you know, we'll write a little play and I'm going to play the lead character. And then I'll ask my friends to be the other ones. And that started to give me a sense of what the people that I asked could do, which is how I then moved forward. And of course I had some experience with, you know, other roles that you guys have played on stage,
right.
But it's very different just voice acting. Like, you don't realize how much the way somebody looks influences you.
Totally.
And how much you don't necessarily realize how versatile somebody is until you just hear them talk. A great example here, to nobody's surprise, is Kate Jones, who, you know, I'd seen on stage a million times, but I didn't realize until we started working on this how unbelievably versatile her voice is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just crazy, right? The fact that she can play both Rita and Miasma.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't even realize that if they don't stick around to hear the credits, because you can't hear any resemblance. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Well, and she does even a small, at least a small part in every episode, right?
Yes, I think to date she is
in every single episode.
She is the only person who's been in every single episode. So listen closely and see if you can catch
scavenger
her.
Hunt.
That's a pretty fun Easter egg, is to find Kate Jones in every episode. that is very important to her, being in every episode. Yeah, so that's one thing. Also, something that I have learned, which I think is kind of interesting, that differs from stage acting, is that just someone being nice to listen to is a huge consideration in a way that it isn't really on stage, mm-hmm. because you have other stuff to distract yourself with. And frankly, that that has a lot to do with why Joshua plays Juno, who does so much of the talking, because he has a really nice voice to listen to. And you had to take that into account, which I think is kind of an interesting thing, because on stage, it just wouldn't be as much of a consideration. So I do weigh that in a little bit when I cast as well, and when I look for people, like, who just has a voice that is pleasing to hear.
Were there any instances where you created a role and then cast somebody in it, and then having cast that person informed you know, oh my goodness, this is not what I thought it was, or there's this huge aspect of this character that we didn't realize, or...
So my, actually, my version of the answer to this entire question is very different for Sophie's, because I don't do any of the casting. But for me, like, to this date, almost none of the actors sound like the way the characters sound in my head when I'm writing the scripts. And that's
pretty weird.
That's not against the actors. That's because I spend all my time with the words on the page,
right,
whereas Sophie spends all of her time with the sounds, right? But the thing is that the more I listen to the actors, the easier it makes it for me to write the actual characters, right? I hold very dear that distance between the way the actors sound and the way the characters sound, so that it's like I've got two voices for each character that I can pull on when I need to, right? We joke sometimes about the fact that there are some lines that I write that for certain characters that are really just for their actors. It's because it's things that I've heard those actors say before that in, like, just in everyday life that I would love to hear them say in this context. Joshua gets a lot of those. Kate gets a lot of those.
Yes.
Right? And it's very, very useful for me to be able to pull on both of those, where it's just there are sort of two slightly different ways that each of the characters talk that I think makes them sound ultimately more dynamic on the actual pitch.
And of course, like, the recurring characters are so heavily influenced by the actors.
Yes.
You know, like, in terms of how we then go on to write them. You know, because, like, you, and I think other people have pointed this out, that you have almost like a period tone.
Yeah.
You know, it's like old, a little old-fashioned sounding. And I think that's a big influence. And also, you sound very intellectual, which is also a big influence, I think. And that heavily comes out in Nureyev for sure. And a lot of, like, I think a lot of Juno's awkwardness, you know, comes from Joshua. And, like, I mean that in the most loving way. But, like, you know, and I think that's a lot of what makes Juno so unbelievably endearing, really. But that wasn't there when we started writing him. You know, like, that was something he brought to the character. And it's so valuable. I mean, come on, we wouldn't love Juno if he weren't like that.
Right. For me, even if the actors don't directly inject a sound into my brain, they definitely inject a spirit, right? There's a way that hearing sort of the cadences that actors have makes me understand better how the characters actually speak.
Yeah. It's amazing that give and take is such a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were there, in the early days, were there characters that you, when you were writing them, you knew, I want, and I know there is a bit of a division of labor here, so I know, right, while Kevin was writing them, Sophie, did you have, were there characters where the writing of the character was influenced before you even heard by who you
because
knew?
Because I knew that we were going to cast somebody?
Sir Mark, I'll jump right in there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. We knew that Stefano was going to...
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, sure, like, Sir Mark is heavily influenced by Stefano.
Sir Mark's original, like, in the earliest versions of the draft, his original speaking patterns were much more in line with, like, Nureyev. They were very kind of... not even Nureyev, more like Rex Glass, right? They were very, like, flowery and like...
Vaguely swashbuckly,
kind of poetic. Yeah. And it ended up
because
instead...
Because he was supposed to be, like, very... Not that this is gone, but he was supposed to be very Cyrano... But, like, that's not Stefano.
And instead that is actually a case where I specifically love when there is that disagreement.
Yes.
Because it creates a middle ground character that is much more nuanced than the broad outline cartoon characters that I start off with.
Yeah, and Stefano has, like, a whole different kind of charm, you know, which I think we really drew upon for Sir Mark. Yeah, that's a good one.
Cool.
Hey, Sophie and Noah.
Yeah.
Yes.
What's up?
Thank you for inviting us to this.
Yeah, please take a seat. What's it like playing characters who are in love?
One really funny and horrible thing about it is that we're all, like, best friends. So it's, you know, just mortifying on one level. But, okay, one thing I will say about it, which applies for me almost more to stage acting, but certainly for voice acting as well. And I think that when you're an artist of any kind, you have a part of your brain that's always turned on, as always looking for material. And I'm 100% certain that Kevin can speak to this as a writer, you know, that when you're a writer, you're always like looking for things in the world like, oh, I can use that as a character, I can use that as a setting, whatever. If you're a visual artist, you know, you see things out in the world, you're like, oh, I want to, you know, paint that or sculpt that. And if you're an actor, or at least for me, I feel like there's an actor part of my brain that's always turned on, and I'm logging material that I might use later when I'm acting. And so, like, as a person in a relationship, there's a part of my brain that's on, and I'm like, oh, this is how I interact with a person that I'm in love with. And this is how my voice sounds. And, you know, in terms of stage acting, like, this is how I physically interact with them. And then I heavily draw on that, when I'm acting a role. So it, for me, I pretty directly draw on life experience.
Was there anything specifically in recording Coyote that was different than other times you've had to do this on stage, or was different because of playing opposite Kate, or anything specific to this episode?
Well, one thing that was different was I don't think that I've ever gotten to play opposite a woman before, which is really wonderful. So I'm really glad that I gave myself that opportunity.
You lucky duck.
Just lucked right into that one. And that's kind of lovely. Well, okay, I mean, you know, just to get into this, like, typically the way you get to play in love as a woman usually is different than the way men get to play that, right? Because most of the roles we get are pretty heteronormative, right? I'm certain you can speak to this as well. And so, like, playing a character who's a lesbian and who's also genderqueer, like, it was really, really cool to get to play another side of that and not to be playing in love in this sort of, like, demure way, but in a way of, like, yeah, I'm going to sweep you off your feet. Like, that was very cool. Yeah. So I think that was one special thing about it.
Mm. I mean, as Sophie says, there is this, on this particular podcast, there is this, like, you know, base level of just, we know each other really well. Like, Joshua and I were roommates in college for a year. Right. Like, which, you know, can help or hinder depending on your take or any given day. But I don't know. I mean, in general, as an actor, I'm a very sort of outside-in actor. I am not in a... Sorry, that was unclear. Not in, like, a method way. Like, I'm not, like, I have to experience the thing to act the thing. But, like, I don't necessarily feel that I have to be internally experiencing emotion in order to portray it.
Sure.
I think I can sort of call upon the sort of signs and symbols of the thing I'm trying to portray, and if I do it well enough, then it's convincing. Right. In terms of making it believable, it's funny with voice acting too, because, you know,
you've lost a whole
you don't get all aspect of the physical, like, oh, like, I see how this is going, because, like, we're standing really close, and, like, you know, we're standing at microphones. And I'm sort of, like, looking out the corner of my eye at Joshua because, you know, I have to face the microphone still. Right.
Do you want to touch a little bit on getting to play a gay character?
Yeah.
Which you also don't really get to do very often.
Honestly, it's easier.
That's interesting based on all of the other stuff that you're saying, you know, about it being outside in and not needing to, like,
totally,
you know,
no, that's right. And that's, it's absolutely true. I think it's more about, like, you know, roadblocks in my head is like, you know, when I'm playing opposite a woman, there's always a part of me that
it's like, as if,
but yeah, no, I mean, no, but in all seriousness, I mean, there's a part of me I mean, there's always a part of me that's going, okay, is this working? Like, in any context, sure. As an actor, right? You know, which, depending on who you ask, is perfectly natural or is why I'll never be great. but like, you know, there's always a part of me that is going, you know, is this working? Did that motion look weird? Does, you know? And so similarly, like, you know, is this convincing? You know? And then there's a part of me that's like, yeah, that is going, do they think I'm in love with a woman? Is that, oh, I don't even know.
So
you know,
funny.
like, I just, I don't know how confused, you know, and it's funny because like this wasn't a concern. I was acting before I came out.
Right.
Like it wasn't, I didn't think about it that way then. Right. Like, but now I've got this whole like X. So it must be pretty much psychological, because I wasn't worried about it then and I was
right.
Fine. But just removing that obstacle of
that's
like,
interesting.
Of like, does anyone believe this? Are they convinced?
I mean, that's just, it's so fascinating because, you know, it's not like anyone has ever said like, all right, well, you can only act opposite this person if you're literally in love with them, you know?
Right.
Like,
right.
So it's kind of nuts. Like, what would their gender, like, even whether that matches up with your sexuality or not, like, how could that matter? And yet, like, it seems to be relevant in some way.
Yeah.
I find that it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
My question is, at this point, so you're talking about signs and symbols of, like, being in love, right?
Yeah.
I'm wondering if, because now it's weird because it's technically the same character, but we have Rex Glass
mm-hmm.
and Peter Nureyev
mm-hmm.
both acting love, right? And it's
don't forget about Duke Rose.
And Duke Rose. But Duke Rose is acting like, you know, matrimonial.
Right. Domesticity.
Yeah.
Is what he's acting.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah.
So my question is, are the signs the same in all cases? Or even for that specific character, right? The two faces of this character.
Yeah. I mean, for what it's worth, I felt like when it was Rex, I felt like, at least until the very end, I was playing sex more than love, you know, like
that's
like
true.
he was one big
man,
come on,
he's,
you know.
Whew, yeah.
So yeah, there was less sort of less at stake. There was less to tether to there, which was fine. I mean, that was great. It was fun. Nureyev qua Nureyev is sort of. I mean, yeah, it's very different because there is that genuine feeling that I think, you know, I think creeps up for him
mm-hmm.
as Glass.
Yes.
But it's, there's an extra layer there that, you know, so it's not really displayed
mm-hmm.
as much. And so there's a certain level of Rex Glass who is, you know, sort of flinging sex against the wall that is Juno. Love that, don't you? That was a good metaphor.
Well, you know what? Juno loves it,
yeah.
So whatever works.
And sort of seeing what sticks, you know?
Oh, God.
Oh, sorry.
Someone get a mop.
Oh, no. I wish this hadn't happened. Let's all go home.
Do you know what I mean, though? Like,
yes, yes.
Like,
yes.
He's just sort of, like, being like, you know, innuendo! Like, in his face. And like, saying, like, did it work?
That's
did
hot.
It work?
That's hot.
Did it work? And then, like, by the time he comes back, he's like, okay, so, like, I know it works. like, he's like, yeah, I can be a little more laser focused, you know.
Oh, my God, that's so funny.
All right. How did you come up with characters' names?
Ooh.
That's a good one.
Yeah, that is fun. I think that people may have already guessed that at least initially, with like the first set of names that we came up with, Juno Steel, Rex Glass, Sasha Wire, we were like, here's some like things.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding. We made a list of
I did
objects.
Not even, yes, put that together.
So actually, I love the story of how we came about the name Juno Steel specifically.
Oh, yes.
Which is that, so I literally just had a list. I just made a list of objects that sounded like they would fit in a science fiction setting. Which is why at one point, I think Juno like obliquely references that Wire apprehended a gangster named Boris Chorus Yablinsky because Kor was like one of the last names that could have been
oh my God.
Juno Steel's last
oh my
name.
God.
Just a list of things.
Yeah, yeah, we just listed objects, and then...
For him, we wanted to go mythological.
We did, yeah, because we're, you know...
Jerks.
Dorks.
Mythology geeks, yeah.
Jerks, dorks.
Yeah, and then, so we, like, listed a bunch of things, but it wasn't, but we weren't deciding, like, this main character, this one guy, what are we going to name him? We were, like, tossing around options for a whole bunch of names, and Juno was on the list.
We actually blew past Juno and came back to it, like, 10 minutes later.
Yeah, and then we were, like, and then I was, like, oh, man, Juno Steel sounds really cool, and then we were, like, well, but that's technically a goddess's name, and then we were, like, wait, but that's great, though. What else was I going to say? Oh, I know what it was. I only recently realized that the reason that particular one felt so good to me, the thing that I have had in my mind this whole time was Artemis Fowl. Like, that's the other thing I've been thinking, which I always have thought was such a great name. Yeah. Like, I love that he's just this boy with a goddess's name, and he's like, yeah, like, suck it, you know? So I think that was, had always rung a bell with me somewhere in there. Yeah. And then, so we do a lot, I think we do a lot of, we try to spread things out as far as parts of the world that we draw on. And
I guess nowadays what we do in terms of our system, whenever we're making a new character is first off, we just see if are there still any just good sci-fi words that have not been overused yet. and then also like a lot of what I think about. So sometimes I will make like a big list of names for a character we have talked about and then just like rapid fire pitch them to Sophie and then they all go down in flames and then I make a new list.
Right. Whichever one I don't say, that's dumb.
Yep.
Then we go with that one.
But like, so very often for surnames or first names, I will think of like, okay, what is a part of the world that like they're, you know, the names traditionally from there we have not, you know, done yet or we haven't done in a while, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. I think the best, fastest way of, like, looking at that in action is Nureyev references obliquely another thief who had the Ruby 7 once named Jet Sekuliak, where Jet is just, I think that's a cool sci-fi word that I wanted as a first name for a while. And then Sekuliak, I did some research and I believe...
It's Inuit?
I think it's Inuit, yeah. And also like sometimes we will take a name from a place and then mutate it a little bit, to create exactly like the sound that we want or something like that.
Yeah. So something to do with aesthetics, something to do with, you know, making sure that we draw on different parts of the world and different myth sets a lot of times.
Yes.
Just sounds cool. Like,
yeah, cool. All right, so we're gonna dive now into some more specific questions about some in-world stuff. Will we see Nureyev in season 2?
Oh, are people invested in?
I
figured.
Certainly hope so.
Wait, who's
who?
Who's
yeah,
that?
We don't know why anyone would be.
Okay, next question.
okay, well, we're not going to answer that, but something I will say is that you will see Noah Symes again. You will hear from Noah Symes again. You're
God
not fired.
I was waiting for confirmation.
No, you know what else I will say? I cannot say whether Nureyev will be back, but we will hear from him again. Mm. In at least some form, which relates to some upcoming things that we have that we haven't talked about yet. So I'm just going to tease that.
Secret plan.
He will in some way appear. Okay. So you have not seen the last of him. That I can't tell you for now whether he will be back, but.
All right.
That's what I got.
Fair enough. Where did the idea for Rangian Street Poker come from?
There are so many drafts of that card game. That card game nearly murdered me several times. But ultimately, the set of rules came about because, you know, high-stakes card games in Bond stories, what's at stake is always either vague or it's, you know, political or it's communicated through, like, eye contact and, like, very minute little interactions because they're trading money, but the money means more than that. We did not have space or, you know, the abilities or sight or anything like that to communicate that. So my question that I asked myself when I kind of sat down to make this game was, ultimately what they need to get out of each other is secrets, is facts. So what we need to do is we need to make that subtext text. We need to make it so that what is being implied in that card game is literally what's at stake, right?
Mm-hmm. We're actually betting secrets. Yeah.
Exactly. So it needs to be a case of verbally betting secrets, because you can't do it in terms of like how people are looking at one another and things like that.
And then all the rest of it is just gags about extremely arcane card games.
Yes.
Really. And as I think we've said before, I feel like we said this in the commentary that you and I did, Noah, that Juno's reaction to it is just my reaction to arcane games. Like, this is just stupid and I shan't put up with it. Yes. Kevin has much more patience for arcane games than I do.
So, yes. Truth in art. A clarifying question. What precisely happened to Juno's eye? Is it still there? Is it gone, or is it still there and just not functioning?
It's not there. It's not functional. It's not in his head. The tumor is gone. Everything is gone.
Starting from square one.
Yeah, there's nothing there.
He got the poison out, and the poison was his eye.
Yeah. So there. I mean, I think we can go ahead and say there's not going to be like, you know, tumorous repercussions.
No.
You know, it's not there anymore. It's just he doesn't have an eye. If that helps.
So we have some sort of world building questions here.
Okay.
Are we ever going to have non-human characters in the Juno universe? Either aliens or AIs or other fabricated.
Boy, Kevin's been lobbying for robots since day one.
Since literally, in my original conception, which I'm very glad we didn't do, so don't take this as I've been, you know, put down. My original conception was that like whoever was going to be in the Prince of Mars position was going to be Juno's old buddy, who is a robot.
Yeah.
Very glad we didn't go that way. For the record,
I've been pushing back on robots this whole time because I'm concerned about it opening up a whole can of worms in terms of rights, you know, and like where do robots come from and how are they produced and like a whole lot of things which have been addressed in a million different ways in a million different sci-fi stories. I'm not ruling it out.
Right.
You know, but like I'm personally not there yet. So I can't say as far as that. I also same deal with AI, you know, it's like it opens up a whole new can of worms with, you know, their rights and whatever and how they fit into society and are they enslaved or are they like people? I don't know. And we have to, I want to be very thoughtful about how we would approach such a thing. I think as far as aliens, like,
yeah, I think that for all of these, kind of including the aliens, actually, like, if you look at the first season, in order to just get through the ancient Martians, right, the idea that there were aliens, we had to devote a season to it, right?
Yeah,
so I don't think we're going to drop anything in carelessly. What I'll say is, in the state of the world right now, I don't think humans have discovered any other aliens.
Yeah, we have more of a situation where humans have just spread throughout, you know, the galaxy and populated, and they haven't really encountered any living aliens.
All right. Someone wants to know, is there any way that we plebeians can listen to the music used on the show?
Yes. Yeah. And I guess this is semi an announcement, because we will be releasing the soundtrack for the show. We don't have a set date yet, so we'll be making like a real announcement about it. But so, I mean, there's original music that Ryan Bibert writes for the show, and that's what we're going to be releasing. There's also other music that is used for the show that is free and can be accessed, and that's all, the links to all that stuff is in the show notes of any given episode. So if anyone, you know, likes the music that plays in the Vixen Valley, whatever, like, you can just look that up. But yeah, Ryan Vibert's music, we're going to be putting out an album in the coming months.
It'll have 9 tracks from across our season. The one thing that I'll say about that too, is if you have enjoyed his music, you want to show him that you've enjoyed it and you want to support him, he has a band that has a couple of albums up on Bandcamp. I'll tell you, it is radically different from what he's done for us. it's kind of a punk grunge sort of thing. They're called Boagrius. It's Boag R-I-U-S, Boagrius. So check them out. If you've liked our music here, you want to support Ryan, that is one way you could do that right now.
I don't even know what punk grunge means.
So we will wait with bated breath for the release of the soundtrack. So do you guys plan the whole season in advance, or do you sort of figure it out as you go?
We do both.
Yes.
And so when we started writing the show, we conceived of it as an anthology, so we didn't plan to plan at all. And then once we figured out that Juno was going to be a series, we realized that we were going to have to map something out, which I think around the, I guess it had to be around the time we got to Prince of Mars was when we started.
Yeah.
No, we had to, because that's where we introduced Miasma.
Right.
And we knew that was where the season was headed.
Yes.
We didn't know every detail of how I was going to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but, and what we've learned is that you can't plan everything out in advance, because,
right,
for example, the fact that we did Angel of Brahma and got into Nureyev's whole backstory,
mm-hmm,
we didn't know we were going to do that when we were on the second story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was something we realized later we wanted to get into.
Right. I mean, one of the things that happens is that you discover, as you're putting individual episodes together, problems arise that you never knew were going to happen.
Right.
So you can plan as much as you want, but your plan needs to be flexible enough to allow for things to shift around. So Angel of Brahma is a really good example where I will complain bitterly about this every chance I get. There are four separate versions of Nureyev's backstory that we wrote. More versions.
Ooh, he's heated.
That are like, they have a lot of similarities, but like, you know, just like the super, one of the, some of the super, super fast versions, in some of those, Mag is much more overtly villainous. And in all of them, except for the one you heard, there is no floating city with the super weapon. You know, the entire premise of that backstory is just not there. And so part of the reason for that is because we wrote an original backstory and, you know, we were going to send it out to actors and stuff. And one of the things that we figured out is just that thematically, it made the whole episode a mess. It made the episode about too many things, and it was trying to bite off too much. And in an outline, that's very, very hard to see.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas
mm-hmm,
once it was done, and we could look at it,
yeah,
and we were like, first off, this episode's way too long. And second, it isn't really about any of the things this season has been about. We very, very quickly had to throw in something else.
Mm-hmm.
That leads to a situation where a lot of the time, either one of us will suddenly advocate for, when somebody asks a really interesting question, one of us will suddenly advocate for, let's not answer that right now.
Mm.
Because we need those blank spaces so that we can, mm-hmm, you know, have wiggle room in
that
the future.
Being said, it's always Kevin who's saying, let's not answer that right now. And I'm usually much more excited about diving in, which is not correct of me, to be clear.
But in terms of what we do know, because there are a lot of things we do know,
mm-hmm,
right? There are events in like Juno's past that we know because they've been referenced, and things that we know we want to do.
Right.
Right.
But we don't know everything.
And we also have general guiding principles for the characters that help us figure out things about,
yes,
them throughout time.
Yes.
Right. An important one for me, for Juno, for example, is that I never want to do an origin story for his depression. Cause that's not how that works. And that,
right,
drives
he's
me nuts.
Just sad.
Right.
And he
so,
was gonna be.
As a result,
no matter what happened,
any version of Juno's past needs to account for that.
Right.
That he came out a sad little baby. This is just how it is, because that's how it is for some people, right?
Yeah.
And in the same way, you know, no matter where you look in Nureyev's past, there are things I don't want to say here because I want them to be secret. But no matter where you look in Nureyev's past, there are certain guiding principles that we understand about how he operates and the kinds of things that he would do that help us to write those when they come up.
Right. And so to give you a sense of like how our planning process works right now. So as of right now, just after the first season has ended, right, and we're going to begin releasing the second season in March, where we're at right now in our creation process is we have like the first three episodes of season two written. We have a pretty clear outline of the second season as far as both continuous storylines, the Juno one and the second Citadel one. So we know broadly where it's going to go. And we have some specific ideas that we're fitting into place. I will also say that I feel I have a very long-term sense of how the full Juno narrative is going to go, but that could take 4 seasons or 20, you know, and a lot of things could happen in between, and I, you know, can't set it in stone right now because so many things are going to change, so that may never come to pass, but it's helpful to me right now to say, well, I think that over the course of the entire show, this is where we're going to go. So that's kind of where we are with our planning process right now.
Well, and this is, I mean, you sort of touched on this, but will we get to explore more of Juno's past in the upcoming season? You know, not an origin story, but...
Resounding yes.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. Whether it's this coming season or later, or perhaps in other forms, we will definitely learn more about his past. And again, yeah, it may not be in the same way that we got like a full flashback,
right,
like we did with the Ray of, but there's a lot to explore there for sure. Yeah.
Yes. All right. So we are running near the end of our time here, but, one final question. If you could rewrite any line or plot point or character trait, what would it be?
Oh, funny you should ask that. Well, I think this is a great time to make a soft announcement, which again, like we'll give more information about this as it comes. If we could rewrite one thing, it would be all of Murderous Mask. And we're gonna.
So, all right. I want to jump right in because I just heard you panic.
Yeah, you not you, Noah. Like everyone listening went.
So, but hang on, because we thought about this
no,
a lot.
No, I'm with them.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Don't panic. It's okay. We hear you.
Yeah. So here's the thing, because I know that like that's a place where a lot of people get really invested in this story. That story does a lot of very special things for people, right? We know how much it means to you to have the situation where you have these two male characters that grow like increasingly attracted to one another, and it actually goes somewhere.
Right.
It's not just a fake out.
Right.
We get that. What I'll say is that we know what you like about that episode.
Yes.
That's not going anywhere.
Right. We know what you like about the episode. We know who you like about the episode. And what we intend to do is develop those things more and get rid of the stuff that no one has ever cared about.
Right.
That we've never heard a peep about from anybody ever.
There are a couple of very large scenes that take up a lot of space and they distract from a lot of stuff. So if you're one of the people that has been wanting to hear a lot more from Cecil or Cassandra, or you want to see, or you know, you really like the relationship that Juno has with Rex Glass, as even as opposed to Peter Nureyev, like this is the chance for that.
Right. This is how we're going to get more of it. We will also say that when we redo it, it won't affect any of the continuity. So if you choose not to listen to it when it comes out, that's okay. It won't affect anything. The story may change slightly, but not in a way that will affect anything moving forward. So it doesn't really matter. And if you're wondering about our reasoning, it's because we truly feel that we have come a very long way in our first season, and we no longer feel that that Murderous Mask as it exists right now, we don't feel that it represents us well. And part of that is in things as simple as the audio quality. Like, that's just not where we are anymore. Like, we know how to make things sound better, and I know how to sound design better.
Or even to the question from way earlier in this where somebody asked, you know, how do you find actors? Early on, before we had a product to show people and say, how do you want to be a part of this?
Oh my gosh.
The answer was, you don't. Right. It's really hard.
Right. And you know, like I play way too many characters in that episode. And there have been very legitimate complaints that it's confusing, you know, because you can't tell what character is whom, you know, and that I want to do better than that. So there are certain concerns that we want to address there. And we want to represent the show better. So we will be rewriting, re-recording, slightly recasting. Don't worry about the recasting. We know what you like.
I'll, I'll also say,
Noah, you're fired.
Well, saw that coming.
I'll also double down on the don't worry about the rewriting again. We've been listening. We've been asking. We've been looking around at what people have been saying about that episode. We know what you like about it.
Yeah.
Our goal is really to
Do more of that.
Yeah. Leave the things that you like as undisturbed as possible.
Yes.
And, you know, carve out some space to do more of that.
Yes.
So one of the really great things that we're going to be able to do also is that from our position now, where we have so many people we're working with, you know, so much more to use in terms of tools. We're super, super excited about the fact that it's going to have a lot more original music.
Yeah, no, there will be some great new music, and we're better now, you know? Like, it's going to be better, I think, in every aspect of the production, and we're really excited to show it to you.
All right. thank you, travelers, for sending in all of your questions. I know we couldn't get to all of them today, but thank you. You know, this Q&A would not have worked without your input. So thank you for staying engaged. We love to hear from you. And yeah, we're excited to come back soon.
Yeah, and we have a lot of announcements to come. And to the point where I don't even think you should think of the off season as the off season, you know, even before the regular episodes resume in March, there is a lot to look forward to, and we're very excited to share it with you.
You heard it here, folks. Thank you. We will see you soon. Goodbye, dear travelers.